Side 9, The Sapphire Rose, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 298. Talon's apparent conversion isn't entirely what it seems to be. Afrael's involved in it, and she's a terrible liar. Her convictions keep getting in the way.
Flute?
Keurig said.
Again? Why would she send Talon here to join us?
Who knows? Sophrenia laughed. Maybe she likes him. Maybe it's part of her obsession with symmetry. Maybe it's something else, something she wants him to do.
Then it wasn't really my fault, was it?
Talon said quickly. Probably not. She smiled at him.
That makes me feel better, he said. I knew you wouldn't like it if I came after you, and I almost choked on all that truth. You should have spanked her when you had the chance, Sparhawk.
Do you have any idea at all of what they're talking about?
Strogan asked Tinian.
Oh, yes,
Tinian replied. I'll explain it to you some day. You won't believe me, but I'll explain it anyway.
Did you find out anything about Martell?
Calton asked Sparhawk.
He rode out through the East Gate early yesterday morning.
We've gained a day on him, then.
Did he have any troops with him?
Only Addis,
Keurig replied. I think it's time for you to tell them everything, Sparhawk, Sophrenia said gravely.
You're probably right, he agreed. He drew in a deep breath.
I'm afraid I haven't been entirely honest with you, my friends, he admitted.
What's new and different about that? Calton asked.
Sparhawk ignored him.
I've been followed ever since I left Gwerig's cave up in Thalesia.
That crossbowman? Euloth suggested.
He might have been involved, but we can't really be sure. The crossbowman and the people he had working for him was probably something Martell came up with. I can't be sure if it's still a problem or not. The one who was responsible is dead now.
Who was it?
Tinian asked intently.
That's not particularly important.
Sparhawk had decided some time ago to keep Perrain's involvement an absolute secret.
Martell has ways to force people to do what he tells them to do. That's one of the reasons we had to get away from the main body of the army. We wouldn't have been very effective if we'd had to spend most of our time trying to guard our backs from the attacks of people we could supposedly trust.
Who was following you if it wasn't the crossbowman? Euloth persisted.
Sparhawk told them about the shadowy form that had haunted him for months now.
And you think it's Azash?
Tinian asked him.
It sort of fits together, wouldn't you say?
How would Azash have known where Gwerig's cave was?
Sir Bathyr asked.
If that shadow's been following you since you left the cave, Azash would almost have to have known, wouldn't he?
Gwerig was saying some fairly insulting things to Azash before Sparhawk killed him, Sophrenia told him. There was a certain amount of evidence that Azash could hear him.
What sort of insults?
Euloth asked curiously.
Gwerig was threatening to cook Azash and eat him, Keurig said shortly.
That's a little daring, even for a troll, Strogan noted.
I'm not so sure, Euloth disagreed. I think Gwerig was totally safe in that cave of his, at least safe from Azash. He didn't have too much to protect him from Sparhawk, as it turned out, though.
Would one of you like to clarify that a bit? Tinian asked him. You Thalesians are the experts on trolls.
I'm not sure how much light we can throw on it, Strogan said. We know a little bit more about trolls than other Alenes, but not very much.
He laughed.
When our ancestors first came to Thalesia, they couldn't tell trolls from ogres or bears. The Styrix told us most of what we know. It seems that when the Styrix first came to Thalesia, there were a few confrontations between the younger Styrix gods and the troll gods. The troll gods realized fairly early on that they were badly overmatched, and they went into hiding. The legends say that Gwerig and Beliom and the Rings were sort of involved in hiding them. It's generally believed that they're somewhere in Gwerig's cave, and that Beliom's somehow protecting them from the Styrix gods.
He looked at Euloth.
Wasn't that sort of what you were getting at?
He asked.
Euloth nodded.
When you combine Beliom and the troll gods, you're talking about enough power to make even Azash step around it a little carefully. That's probably why Gwerig could make the kind of threats he did.
How many troll gods are there? Calton asked.
Five, aren't there, Euloth?
Strogan said. Euleth nodded.
The god of eat, he supplied. The god of kill. The god of...
He broke off and gave Sophrenia a slightly embarrassed look.
Let's just call it the god of fertility, he continued lamely. Then there's the god of ice. All kinds of weather, I suppose. And the god of fire. Trolls have a fairly simple view of the world.
Then Azash would have known about it when Sparhawk came out of the cave with Beliom and the rings, Tinian said, and he probably would have followed.
With unfriendly intentions, Talon added.
He's done it before, Gurek shrugged. He sent the Damok to chase Sparhawk all over Rendor, and the Seeker to try to run us down in Lemurkand. At least he's predictable.
Davier was frowning.
I think we're overlooking something here, he said.
Such as? Calton asked.
I can't quite put my finger on it, Davier admitted, but I get the feeling that it's fairly important.
They left Kadok at dawn the following morning and rode eastward toward the city of Moterra, under skies that continued gray and cloudy. The murky sky, coupled with their conversation of the previous evening, made them all gloomy and downcast, and they rode mostly in silence. About noon, Sophrenia suggested a halt.
"Gentlemen," she said quite firmly, "this isn't a funeral procession, you know."
"You could be wrong there, little mother," Calton said to her. "I didn't find much to lift my spirits in last night's discussion."
"I think we'd all better start looking for cheerful things to think about," she told them. "We're riding into some fairly serious danger. Let's not make it worse by piling gloom and depression on top of it. People who think they're going to lose usually do."
"There's a lot of truth there," Euleth agreed. "One of my brother knights at Hayd is absolutely convinced that every set of dice in the world hates him. I've never seen him win, not even once."
"If he's been playing with your dice, I can see why," Calton accused.
"I'm hurt," Euleth said plaintively.
"Enough to throw those dice away?"
"Well, no, not quite that much. We really ought to come up with something cheerful to talk about, though."
"We could find some wayside tavern and get drunk, I suppose," Calton said hopefully.
"No," Euleth shook his head. "I found that ale just makes a bad mood worse. After 4 or 5 hours of drinking, we'd probably all be crying into our tankards."
"We could sing hymns," Davier suggested brightly.
Calton and Tinian exchanged a long look, and then they both sighed.
"Did I ever tell you about the time when I was down in Camoria, and this lady of high station became enamored of me?" Tinian began.
"Not that I recall," Calton replied rather quickly.
"Well, as I remember it," Tinian began, and then told them a long, amusing, and just slightly off-color account of what was probably an entirely fictitious amorous adventure. Euleth followed by telling them the story of the unfortunate Genidian knight who had aroused a passion in the heart of an ogress. His description of the singing of the love-stricken female reduced them all to helpless laughter. The stories, richly embellished with detail and humor, lightened their mood, and they all felt much better by sunset when they halted for the day. Even with frequent changes of horses, it took them 12 days to reach Moterra, an unlovely town lying on a flat, marshy plain extending out from the west fork of the river Gyrus. They reached the city about midday. Sparhawk and Curic once again sought out information, while the rest of the party rested their horses in preparation for the ride northward toward Parlor. Since they still had a number of hours of daylight left, they saw no reason to spend the night in Moterra.
"Well," Calton asked Sparhawk as the big Pandion and his squire rejoined the group.
"Martell went north," Sparhawk answered.
"We're still right behind him, then," Tinian said. "Did we pick up any more time?"
"No," Curic replied. "He's still 2 days ahead of us."
"Well," Tinian shrugged, "since we're going that way anyway..."
"How far is it to Parlor?"
Strogan asked.
150 leagues, Calton told him. 15 days at least." "We're moving on in the season," Curic said. "We're bound to run into snow in the mountains of Zamok."
"That's a cheery thought," Calton said.
"It's always good to know what to expect."
The sky continued gloomy, though the air was cool and dry. About midway through their journey, they began to encounter the extensive diggings that had turned the ancient battlefield at Lake Rundera into a wasteland.
They saw a few of the treasure hunters, but passed them without incident. Perhaps something had changed it, or perhaps it was because he was out of doors instead of in some candle-lit room. But this time, when Sparhawk caught that faint glimmer of darkness and menacing shadow at the very corner of his vision, something was actually there. It was late in the afternoon of a depressing day that they had spent riding through a landscape denuded of all vegetation and littered with great mounds of raw, dug-over earth. When Sparhawk caught that familiar flicker and its accompanying chill, he half turned in his saddle and looked squarely at the shadow that had haunted him for so long. He reined Farron in.
"Sophronia," he said quite calmly.
"Yes?"
"You wanted to see it. I think that if you turn around rather slowly, you'll be able to look as much as you want. It's just beyond that large pond of muddy water." She turned to look. "Can you see it?" he asked her.
"Quite clearly, dear one."
"Gentlemen," Sparhawk said to the others then, "our shadowy friend seems to have come out of hiding. It's about 150 yards behind us." They turned to look.
"It's almost like a cloud of some kind, isn't it?" Calton noted. "I've never seen a cloud like that before."
Talon shuddered.
"Dark, isn't it?"
"Why do you suppose it decided not to hide any more?"
Euloth murmured. They all turned, looking to Sophronia for some kind of explanation.
"Don't ask me, gentlemen," she said helplessly. "Something has changed, though."
"Well, at least we know that Sparhawk hasn't just been seeing things for all this time," Calton said. "What do we do about it?"
"What can we do about it?" Euloth asked him. "You don't have much luck fighting with clouds and shadows with axes or swords."
"So what do you suggest, then?"
"Ignore it," Euloth shrugged. "It's the king's highway, so it's not breaking any laws if it wants to follow along, I guess."
The next morning, however, the cloud was nowhere to be seen. It was late in the autumn when they once again rode into the familiar city of Pallor. As had become their custom, the Domi and his men camped outside the city walls, and Sparhawk and the others rode on to the same inn where they had stayed before.
"It's good to see you again, Sir Knight,"
the innkeeper greeted Sparhawk as the black-armored Pandion came back down the stairs.
"It's good to be back," Sparhawk replied, not really meaning it. "How far is it to the east gate from here?" he asked.
It was time to go start asking questions about Martell again.
"About 3 streets over, my lord,"
the innkeeper replied. "It's closer than I thought." Then something occurred to Sparhawk.
"I was just about to go out to ask around about a friend of mine who passed through Pallor 2 days ago," he said. "You might be able to save me some time, neighbor."
"I'll do what I can, Sir Knight."
"He has white hair, and there's a fairly attractive lady with him, as well as a few others. It is possible that he stopped here in your inn?"
"Why, yes, my lord. As a matter of fact, he did. They were asking questions about the road to Vileta. Although I can't for the life of me think why anyone in his right mind would want to go into Zamok at this particular time."
"He has something he wants to take care of there, and he's always been a rash and foolhardy man. Was I right? Was it 2 days ago when he stopped?"
"Exactly 2 days, my lord. He's riding hard, judging from the condition of his horses."
"Do you happen to remember which room was his?"
"It's the one the lady with your party is staying in, my lord."
"Thank you, neighbor," Sparhawk told him. "We certainly wouldn't want our friend to get away from us."
"Your friend was nice enough, but I certainly didn't care much for that big one who's with him. Does he improve at all once you get to know him?"
"Not noticeably, no. Thanks again, friend."
Sparhawk went back upstairs and rapped on Sophronia's door.
"Come in, Sparhawk," she replied.
"I wish you wouldn't do that," he said as he entered.
"Do what?"
"Call me by name before you've even seen me. Couldn't you at least pretend that you don't know who's knocking at your door?"
She laughed.
"Martell went through here 2 days ago, Sophronia. He stayed in this very room. Could that in any way be useful to us?"
She thought about it a moment.
"It may just be, Sparhawk. What did you have in mind?"
"I'd sort of like to find out what his plans are. He knows we're right on his heels, and he's likely to try to delay us. I'd like to get a few specifics on any traps he may be laying for us."
Can you arrange to let me see him, or hear him at least?
She shook her head. He's too far away.
Well, so much for that idea.
Perhaps not.
She thought for a moment.
I think that perhaps it's time for you to get to know Belliom a little better, Sparhawk.
Would you like to clarify that?
There's some sort of connection between Belliom and the troll gods and the rings. Let's investigate that.
Why involve the troll gods at all, Sophrania? If there's a way to use Belliom, why not just do that and leave the troll gods out of it altogether?
I'm not sure if Belliom would understand us, Sparhawk. And if it did, I'm not sure that we'd understand what it was doing to obey us.
It collapsed that cave, didn't it?
That was very simple. This is a little more complicated. The troll gods would be much easier to talk with, I think, and I want to find out just how closely Belliom's linked to them, if I can, and just how much you can control them by using Belliom.
You want to experiment, in other words.
You might put it that way, I suppose. But it might be safer to experiment now when there's nothing crucial at stake than later when our lives might hinge on the outcome. Lock the door, Sparhawk. Let's not expose the others to this just yet.
He crossed to the door and slid the iron bolt into place.
You're not going to have time to think when you talk with the troll gods, dear one, so get everything set in your mind before you start. You're going to issue commands and nothing else. Don't ask them questions and don't seek out explanations. Just tell them to do things. And don't worry about how they manage to obey. We want to see and hear the man who was in this room 2 sleeps ago. Just tell them to put his image,
she looked around the room, then pointed at the hearth,
in that fire there. Tell Belliom that you will talk with one of the troll gods. Probably Quadj, the troll god of fire. He's the most logical one to deal with flame and smoke.
Sophrania obviously knew a great deal more about the troll gods than she had told them. Quadj. Sparhawk repeated. Then he had a sudden idea. "What's the name of the troll god of Eat?" he asked her.
"Gnomb," she replied. "Why?"
"It's something I'm still working on. If I can put it together, I might try it and see if it works."
"Don't extemporize, Sparhawk. You know how I feel about surprises."
"Take off your gauntlets and remove Belliom from the pouch. Don't let it out of your grasp. And be sure that the rings are touching it at all times."
"Do you still remember the troll language?"
"Yes. Yuleth and I have been practicing."
"Good. You can speak to Belliom in Aline, but you'll have to speak to Quadj in his own tongue. Tell me what you did today, in troll."
The words were halting at first, but after a few moments he became more fluent. The changeover from the Aline language to troll involved a profound shift in his thinking. In their language itself lay some of the character of the trolls. It was not a pleasant character, and it involved concepts entirely alien to the Aline mind, except at the deepest, most primitive level.
"All right," she told him. "Come to the fire and let's begin."
"Be like iron, Sparhawk. Don't hesitate or explain anything. Just give commands." He nodded and removed his gauntlets. The 2 blood-red rings, one on each of his hands, glowed in the firelight. He reached inside his surcoat and took out the pouch. Then he and his tutor stood before the hearth and looked into the crackling flames.
"Open the pouch," Sophrania instructed.
He worked the knots free.
"Now take Belliom out. Order it to bring Quadj to you. Then tell Quadj what you want. You don't have to be too explicit. Quadj will understand your thoughts. Pray that you never understand his."
He drew in a deep breath and set the pouch down on the hearth. "Here goes," he said. He pulled the pouch open and took the Belliom out. The sapphire rose was icy cold as he touched it. He lifted it, trying to keep his sense of awe at the sight of it far away from his mind. "Blue rose," he snapped, holding the jewel in both hands. "Bring the voice of Quadj to me." He felt a strange shift in the jewel, and a single spot of bright red appeared deep within the azure petals. The Belliom suddenly grew hot in his hands. "Quadj," Sparhawk barked in the language of trolls. "I am Sparhawk from Elenia. I have the rings. Quadj must do as I command." Belliom shuddered in his hand.
I seek Martell for Melania, Sparhawk continued. Martell for Melania stayed in this place 2 sleeps ago. Quadge will show Sparhawk for Melania what he wishes to see in the fire. Quadge will make it so Sparhawk for Melania can hear what he wishes to hear. Quadge will obey. Now. Faintly, as from very far away in some hollow place filled with echoes, there came a howl of rage, a howl overlaid with a crackling sound as of some huge fire. The flames dancing along the tops of the oak logs in the fireplace lowered until they were little more than a sickly glimmering. Then they rose, bright yellow and filling the entire opening with a sheet of nearly incandescent fire. Then they froze, no longer a flickering or a dancing, but simply a flat, unwavering sheet of motionless yellow. The heat from the fireplace stopped at once as if a pane of thick glass had been set in front of it. Sparhawk found himself looking into a tent. Martell, drawn and weary-looking, sat at a rough table across from Aeneas, who looked even worse. "Why can't you find out where they are?" the primate of Cimera was demanding. "I don't know, Aeneas," Martell grated. "I've called up every creature Otha gave me, and none of them has found anything." "Oh, mighty Pandion," Aeneas sneered. "Maybe you should have stayed in your order longer to give Sophrenia time to teach you more than parlor tricks for the amusement of children." "You're getting very close to the point of outliving your usefulness to me, Aeneas," Martell said ominously. "Otha and I can put any churchman on the archprelate's throne and achieve what we want. You're not really indispensable, you know." And that answered the question of just who was taking orders from whom, once and for all. The tent flap opened, and the ape-like Addus slouched in. His armor was a mismatched accumulation of bits and pieces of rust-splotched steel drawn from a half-dozen different cultures. Addus, Sparhawk noticed again, had no forehead. His hairline began at his shaggy eyebrows. "It died," he reported in a voice that was half-snarl. "I should make you walk, you idiot," Martell told him. "It was a weak horse," Addus shrugged. "It was perfectly fine until you spurred it to death. Go steal another one." Addus grinned. "A farm horse?" "Any kind of horse you can find. Don't take all night killing the farmer, though, or amusing yourself with his women. And don't burn the farmstead down. Let's not light up the sky and announce our location." Addus laughed. At least it sounded like a laugh. Then he left the tent. "How can you stand that brute?" Aeneas shuddered. "Addus? He's not so bad. Think of him as a walking battle axe. I use him for killing people. I don't sleep with him. Speaking of that, have you and Orisa resolved your differences yet?" "That harlot," Aeneas said with a certain contempt. "You knew what she was when you took up with her, Aeneas," Martell told him. "I thought her depravity was part of what attracted you to her." Martell leaned back. "It must be Belium," he mused.
"What must?"
"It's probably the Belium that's keeping my creatures from locating Sparhawk."
"Wouldn't Azash himself be able to find out?"
"I don't give orders to Azash, Aeneas. If he wants me to know something, he tells me. It could just be that Belium's more powerful than he is. When we get to his temple, you can ask him if you're really curious about it. The question might offend him, but it's entirely up to you."
"How far have we come today?"
"No more than 7 leagues. Our pace slowed noticeably after Addus ripped out his horse's guts with his spurs."
"How far to the Zamok border?"
Martell unrolled a map and consulted it. "I make it about 50 more leagues, 5 days or so. Sparhawk can't be more than 3 days behind us, so we'll have to keep up the pace."
"I'm exhausted, Martell. I can't keep on going like this."
"Every time you start brooding about how tired you are, just imagine how it would feel to have Sparhawk's sword sliding through your guts,
or how exquisitely painful it's going to be when Alana beheads you with a pair of sewing scissors, or a bread knife.
Sometimes I wish I'd never met you, Martell.
The feeling's entirely mutual, old boy.
Once we cross the border into Zaymark, we should be able to slow Sparhawk down a bit. A few ambushes along the way ought to make him a bit more cautious.
We were ordered not to kill him, Aeneas objected. Don't be an idiot. As long as he has Beliom, no human could possibly kill him. We were ordered not to kill him, even if we could.
But Azash didn't say anything about the others. The loss of a few of his companions might upset our invincible enemy. He doesn't look very much like it, but Sparhawk's a sentimentalist at heart.
You'd better go get some sleep. We'll start out again just as soon as Otis gets back.
In the dark?
Aeneas sounded incredulous. What's the matter, Aeneas? Are you afraid of the dark? Think about swords in the belly, or the sound of a bread knife sawing on your neck bone. That should make you brave.
Quadge, Sparhawk said sharply. Enough. Go away now.
The fire returned to normal.
Blue Rose, Sparhawk said then. Bring the voice of Gnomb to me.
What are you doing? Sophrenia exclaimed. But Beliom had already started to respond. The pinpoint of light within the glowing blue petals was a sickly mixture of green and yellow, and Sparhawk suddenly had a foul taste in his mouth, a taste much like the smell of half-decayed meat.
Gnomb, Sparhawk said in that harsh voice. I am Sparhawk from Alania, and I have the rings. Gnomb must do as I command. I hunt. Gnomb will help me hunt. I am two sleeps behind the man-thing that is my prey. Gnomb will make it so that my hunters and I can catch the man-thing we seek. Sparhawk from Alania will tell Gnomb when, and Gnomb will aid our hunt. Gnomb will obey.
Again there was that hollow, echoing howl of rage, a howl filled this time with a slobbering, gnawing sound, and a horrid, wet smacking of lips.
Gnomb! Go away, now! Sparhawk commanded. Gnomb will come again at Sparhawk from Alania's command.
The greenish-yellow spot vanished, and Sparhawk thrust the Beliom back into the pouch.
Are you mad? Sophrenia exclaimed.
No, I don't think so. I want to be so close behind Martell that he won't have time to set up any ambushes. He frowned. It's beginning to look as if the attempts to kill me really were Martell's own idea, he said. He seems to have different orders now. That clarifies things a bit, but now I have to start worrying about how to protect you and the others. He made a face. There's always something, isn't there?
Chapter 22
Sparhawk. It was Curic, and he was shaking his lord into wakefulness. It's about an hour before dawn. You wanted me to wake you.
Don't you ever sleep?
Sparhawk sat up in his bed, yawning. Then he swung his legs out of bed and put his feet on the floor.
I slept fine.
Curic looked critically at his friend.
You're not eating enough, he accused. Your bones are sticking out. Get dressed, I'll go wake the others, and then I'll come back and help you into your armor.
Sparhawk rose and pulled on his quilted and rust-splotched undergarments.
Very chic, Strogan observed sardonically from the doorway. Is there some obscure part of the knightly code that prohibits laundering those garments?
They take a week to dry.
Are they really necessary?
Have you ever worn armor, Strogan?
God forbid.
Try it sometime. The padding keeps the armor from grinding off your skin in unusual places.
Ah, the things we endure in order to be stylish.
Are you really planning to turn back at the Zaymok border?
The Queen's orders, old boy. Besides, I'd just be in your way. I am profoundly unsuited to confront a god. Frankly, I think you're insane. No offense intended, of course.
Are you going back to Emsat from Simera?
If your wife gives me permission to leave, I really should get back, if only to check over the books.
Tell's fairly dependable, but he is a thief, after all.
And then?
Who knows? Strogan shrugged. I'm at loose ends in the world, Sparhawk. I have a unique sort of freedom. I don't have to do anything I don't want to do. Oh, I almost forgot. I didn't really come by this morning to discuss the ins and outs of liberty with you.
He reached inside his doublet.
A letter for you, my lord, he said with a mocking bow. From your wife, I believe.
How many of these do you have? Sparhawk asked, taking the folded sheet.
Strogan had delivered one of Alana's brief, impassioned notes to her husband in Caddick, and yet another in Moterra.
That's a state secret, my friend.
Do you have some sort of agenda, or are you distributing them when the spirit moves you?
A little of each, old boy. There is an agenda, of course, but I'm to use my own judgment in these matters. If I see that you're becoming downcast or moody, I'm supposed to brighten your day. I'll leave you to your reading now.
He stepped back out into the hallway and moved off down the corridor toward the stairs leading to the lower floor of the inn. Sparhawk broke the seal and opened Alana's letter.
Beloved, if all has gone well, you're in parlor by now. This is terribly awkward, you know. I'm trying to look into the future, and my eyes aren't strong enough for that. I'm talking to you from weeks and weeks in the past, and I haven't the faintest idea of what's been happening to you. I dare not tell you of my anguish or my desolation at this unnatural separation, for should I unburden my heart to you, I would weaken your resolve, and that could endanger you. I love you, my Sparhawk, and I am torn between wishing that I were a man so that I could share your danger, and if need be, lay down my life for you, and glorying in the fact that I am a woman, and can lose myself in your embrace.
From there, Sparhawk's young queen launched into detailed reminiscence of their wedding night that was far too personal and private to bear repeating.
How was the queen's letter? Strogan asked as they were saddling their horses in the courtyard while the emerging dawn laid a dirty stain across the cloudy eastern horizon.
Literate, Sparhawk replied laconically.
That's an unusual characterization.
Sometimes we lose sight of the real person lying behind the state robes, Strogan. Elana's a queen right enough, but she's also an 18-year-old girl who seems to have read too many of the wrong books.
I'd hardly have expected such a clinical description from a new bridegroom.
I have a lot on my mind just now. Sparhawk pulled the cinch of his saddle tighter. Farron grunted, filled his belly with air, and deliberately stepped on his master's foot. Almost absently, the Pandion kneed his mount in the stomach.
Keep your eyes open today, Strogan, he advised. Some peculiar things are likely to happen.
Such as what?
I'm not really sure.
If everything goes well, we'll cover a great deal more ground today than usual. Stay with the Domi and his Piloi. They're an emotional people, and out-of-the-ordinary things sometimes upset them. Just keep assuring them that everything's under control.
Is it?
I haven't got the foggiest idea, old boy. I'm trying very hard to be optimistic about it, however.
Strogan, he felt, sort of had that coming.
The dawn came slowly that morning, since the cloud cover rolling in from the east had thickened during the night. At the top of the long slope leading up from the northern end of the lead-gray sheet of Lake Rondera, Kring and his Piloi joined them.
"It's good to be back in Piloja again, friend Sparhawk," Kring said, a good-humored grin on his scarred face,
"even in this cluttered and over-plowed part of the kingdom."
"How many days to the Zamok border, Domi?" Tinian asked.
5 or 6, friend Tinian," the Domi replied.
"We'll start out in just a few moments," Sparhawk told his friends. "There's something Sophrenia and I have to do."
He motioned to his tutor, and they rode some distance away from the group sitting their horses on the grassy hilltop.
"Well?" he said to her.
"Must you really do this, dear one?" she pleaded.
"I think so, yes. It's the only way I can think of to protect you and the others from ambushes when we reach the Zamok border."
He reached inside his surcoat, removed the pouch, and took off his gauntlets. Once again the Belliom felt very cold in his hands, a chill almost like the touch of ice.
"Blue Rose," he commanded, "bring the voice of Gnomb to me."
The jewel sullenly warmed in his hands. Then the greenish-yellow spot appeared within its depths, accompanied by the rotten meat taste in Sparhawk's mouth.
"Gnomb," he said,
I am Sparhawk from Alania, and I have the rings. I hunt now. Gnomb will aid my hunting as I commanded. Gnomb will do it. Now!
He waited tensely, but nothing happened. He sighed.
Gnomb, he said. Go away now.
He put the sapphire rose back into its pouch, knotted the strings, and thrust the pouch back inside his surcoat.
Well, he said ruefully, so much for that. You said he'd let me know if he couldn't help. He just let me know, all right. It's a little awkward to find out about it at this stage of the proceedings, though.
Don't give up just yet, Sparhawk, Sophronia told him.
Nothing happened, little mother.
Don't be too sure.
Well, let's go on back. It seems we're going to have to do this the hard way.
The party rode out at a brisk trot, moving down the far side of the hill with the pale disk of the new-risen sun hanging behind the clouds on the eastern horizon. The farmland lying to the east of Pollard was in the last stages of the harvest, and serfs were already in the fields, small figures in dun or blue looking like immobile toys far back from the road.
Serfdom doesn't seem to encourage much enthusiasm for work, Keurig observed critically. Those people out there don't seem to be moving at all.
If I were a serf, I don't think I'd be very interested in exerting myself either, Colton said. They rode on at a canter, crossed a wide valley, and climbed a low chain of hills. The clouds were a bit thinner here to the east, and the sun just above the horizon was more distinct. Kring sent out his patrols, and they rode on. Something was wrong. But Sparhawk could not exactly put his finger on what it was. The air was very still, and the sound of the horse's hooves seemed quite loud, and unnaturally crisp in the soft dirt of the road. Sparhawk looked around and saw that his friend's expression seemed uneasy. They were halfway across the next valley when Keurig reined in with a sudden oath.
That does it, he said. What's the matter? Sparhawk asked him.
How long would you say we've been on the road?
An hour or so. Why? Look at the sun, Sparhawk.
Sparhawk looked at the eastern horizon where the almost obscured disk of the sun hung just over a gently rounded line of hills.
It seems to be where it always is, Keurig, he said. Nobody's moved it. That's just the point, Sparhawk. It's not moving. It hasn't moved an inch since we started. It came up and then it stopped.
They all stared toward the east. It's fairly common, Keurig, Tinian said. We've been riding up and down hills. That always seems to put the sun in a different position. Where it seems to be depends on how high up or down the hill you are.
I thought so myself, Sartinian, at first. But I'll swear to you that the sun hasn't moved since we left that hilltop to the east of Pollard.
Be serious, Keurig, Colton scoffed. The sun has to move.
Not this morning, apparently.
What's going on here?
It's a Sparhawk!
Barrett's voice was shrill, hovering just on the edge of hysteria.
Look!
Sparhawk turned his head in the direction the apprentice knight was pointing a shaking hand. It was a bird, a completely ordinary-looking bird, a lark of some kind, Sparhawk judged. Nothing at all was unusual about it, if one were to overlook the fact that it hung absolutely motionless in mid-air, looking for all the world as if it had been stuck there with a pin. They all looked around, their eyes a little wild. Then Sophronia began to laugh.
I don't really see anything funny about this, Sophronia, Keurig told her.
Everything's fine, gentlemen, she told them.
Fine, Tinian said. What's happened to the sun and that idiotic bird?
Sparhawk stopped the sun and the bird.
Stopped the sun? Davier exclaimed. That's impossible.
Apparently not. Sparhawk talked with one of the troll gods last night, she told them. He said that we were hunting and that our prey was far ahead of us. He asked the troll god Gnomb to help us catch up, and Gnomb seems to be doing just that.
I don't follow you, Colton said. What's the sun got to do with hunting?
It's not all that complicated, Colton, she said calmly. Gnomb stopped time, that's all.
That's all? How do you stop time?
I have no idea. She frowned. Maybe stopping time isn't quite accurate. What's really happening is that we're moving outside of time. We're in that winking of an eye between 1 second and the next.
What's keeping that bird up in the air, Lady Sophronia?
Thayrit demanded.
His last wing beat, probably. The rest of the world is moving along quite normally. People out there aren't even aware of the fact that we're passing through. When the gods do the things we ask them to do, they don't always do them in the way we expect. When Sparhawk told Gnomb that he wanted to catch up to Martell, he was thinking about time more than the miles, so Gnomb is moving us through time, not distance. He'll control time for as long as it takes us. Covering the distance is up to us.
Then Strogan came forward at a gallop.
"Sparhawk!" he cried. "What in God's name did you do?"
Sparhawk briefly explained.
"Just go back and calm the Paloi. Tell them that it's an enchantment. Explain that the world is frozen. Nothing will move until we get to where we want to go."
"Is that the truth?"
"More or less, yes."
"Do you actually think they'll believe me?"
"Invite them to come up with their own explanations if they don't like mine. You can unfreeze things later, can't you?"
"Of course.
At least I hope so."
Sophronia, Talon said tentatively, "all the rest of the world is stopped dead, right?"
"Well, that's the way it appears to us. Nobody else perceives it that way, though."
"Other people can't even see us then, right? They won't even know we're here."
A slow, almost reverent smile came to the boy's lips.
"Well now," he said. "Well, well, well."
Strogan's eyes also became very bright.
"Well now indeed, Your Grace," he agreed.
"Never mind, you two,"
Sophronia said sharply. "Strogan," Sparhawk added as an afterthought, "tell Kring that there's no real need to hurry. We might as well conserve the horses. Nobody out there is going to go anywhere or do anything until we get to where we want to go, anyway."
It was eerie to canter through that perpetual murky sunrise. It was neither cold, nor warm, nor damp, nor dry. The world around them was silent, and unmoving birds dotted the air. Serfs stood like statues in the fields, and once they passed a tall white birch tree that had been brushed by a passing breeze just before the troll god Gnomb had frozen time. A cloud of motionless golden leaves hung in the air to the leeward side of the tree.
"What time do you think it is?" Calden asked after they had ridden for several leagues. Yulith squinted at the sky.
"I make it about sunrise," he replied.
"Oh, very, very funny, Yulith," Calden said sarcastically. "I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm starting to get a little hungry."
"You were born hungry," Sparhawk told him. They ate trail rations and moved on again. There was no real need to hurry, but the sense of urgency they had all felt since they had left Kyrelos nagged at them, and they were soon cantering. To have proceeded at a leisurely walk would have seemed unnatural. An hour or so later, though it was really impossible to tell, Kring came up from the rear.
"I think there's something behind us, friend Sparhawk," he said.
Kring's tone had a respectful awe about it. It's not every day that one can talk with a man who stops the sun. Sparhawk looked at him sharply.
"Are you sure?" he asked.
"Not really," Kring admitted. "It's a feeling more than anything. There's a very dark cloud low to the ground off to the south. It's a goodly way off, so it's hard to tell for sure, but it seems to be pacing us."
Sparhawk looked toward the south. It was that same cloud again, larger, blacker, and more ominous. The shadow could follow him even here, it appeared.
"Have you seen it move at all?" he asked Kring.
"No, but we've come quite some distance since we stopped to eat, and it's still just over my right shoulder where it was when we set out."
"Keep an eye on it," Sparhawk said tersely. "See if you can catch it actually moving."
"Right," the Domi agreed, wheeling his horse. They set up camp for the night after they had covered approximately the distance they would have gone in a normal day. The horses were confused, and Farron kept watching Sparhawk with a hard-eyed look of suspicion.
"It's not my fault, Farron," Sparhawk said as he unsaddled the big roan.
"How can you lie to that poor beast like that, Sparhawk?" Carlton said from nearby. "Have you no shame? It is your fault." Sparhawk slept poorly. The unchanging light was always there. He slept for as long as he could and then rose. The others were also stirring. "Good morning, Sparhawk," Sophronia said ironically. Her expression was a bit put out. "What's the matter?"
"I miss my morning tea. I tried to heat some rocks in order to boil water, but it didn't work. Nothing works, Sparhawk. No spells, no magic, nothing. We're totally defenseless in this never-never land you and Gnomb have created, you know."
"What can attack us, little mother?" he asked gravely. "We're outside of time. We're someplace where nothing can reach us." It was about noon when they discovered just how wrong that particular assessment had been.
"It's moving, Sparhawk!" Talon shouted as they approached an immobile village. "That cloud! It's moving!"
The cloud that Kring had noticed the day before was definitely moving now. It was inky black. It rolled across the ground toward the small cluster of thatch-roofed serfs' huts huddled in a shallow dale, and a low rumble of sullen thunder, the first sound they had heard since Gnomb had locked them in time, accompanied its inexorable march. Behind it the trees and grasses were all dead and decaying, as if that momentary touch of darkness had blighted them in an instant. The cloud engulfed the village, and when it had passed, the village was gone, as if it had never existed. As the cloud drew nearer, Sparhawk heard a rhythmic sound, a kind of thudding as of dozens of bare heels striking the earth, and accompanying that, a brutish grunting as might come from a throng of beasts uttering low, guttural barks in evenly spaced unison.
"Sparhawk," Sophronia cried urgently, "use the Belium! Break up that cloud! Call Quadge!"
Sparhawk fumbled with the pouch, then threw his gauntlets to the ground and tore open the canvas sack with his bare hands. He lifted out the sapphire rose in both hands. "Blue rose!" he half-shouted. "Bring Quadge!" The Belium grew hot in his hands, and that single spark of red appeared in its petals. "Quadge!" Sparhawk half-shouted. "I am Sparhawk from Alania. Quadge will burn away the dark that comes. Quadge will make it so Sparhawk from Alania can see what is inside the cloud. Do it, Quadge! Now!" Again there was that howl of frustration and rage, as the troll god was compelled against his will to obey. Then, immediately in front of the rolling black cloud, there rose a long, high sheet of roaring flame. Brighter and brighter the flame grew, and Sparhawk could feel the waves of intense heat blasting back at them from the wall of fire. The cloud advanced inexorably, seeming to ignore the wall. "Blue rose!" Sparhawk snarled in the troll tongue. "Help Quadge! Blue Rose will send its power and the power of all the troll gods to help Quadge. Do it! Now!" The answering blast of power nearly knocked Sparhawk from his saddle, and Farron reeled back, flattening his ears and baring his teeth. Then the cloud stopped. Great rents and tears appeared in it, only to be almost instantly repaired. The flame undulated, rising, then falling into sickly glimmerings, then flaring anew as the two forces contended with each other. At last, the darkness of the cloud began to fade, even as night fades from the sky with the approach of dawn. The flames grew higher, more intensely bright. The cloud sickened yet more. It grew wispy and tattered.
"We're winning!" Carlton exclaimed.
"We?" Kyorik said, picking up Sparhawk's gauntlets. Then, as if it had been ripped away by a gale, the cloud streamed away. Sparhawk and his friends saw what had made the grunting sound. They were immense and human-like, which is to say that they had arms and legs and heads. They were dressed in furs and carried weapons crafted of stone, axes and spears for the most part. Their humanity ended there. They had receding brows and protruding, muzzle-like mouths, and they were not so much hairy as they were furred. Although the cloud had dissipated,
They continued their advance, a kind of shuffling trot. Their feet struck the ground in unison, and they barked that guttural grunt with each thudding step. They momentarily paused at regular intervals, and from somewhere in their midst there arose a high-pitched wail, a kind of shrill ululation. Then the rhythmic barking and stamping trot would begin again. They wore helmets of a sort, the skull caps of unimaginable beasts decorated with horns, and their faces were smeared with colored mud in intricate designs.
"Are they trolls?"
Colton's voice was shrill.
"Not like any trolls I've ever seen," Ulith replied, reaching for his axe.
"All right, my children," the Domi shouted to his men. "Let us clear the beasts from our path." He drew his saber, held it aloft, and shouted a great war cry. The Piloi charged.
"Kring!" Sparhawk yelled. "Wait!"
But it was too late. Once unleashed, the savage tribesmen from the eastern marches of Pelosia could not again be reined in. Sparhawk swore. He stuffed the Belium inside his surcoat. "Bayret," he commanded, "take Sophrenia and Talon to the rear. The rest of you, let's go lend a hand." It was not an organized fight in any sense of the word that civilized men would understand. After the first charge of Kring's tribesmen, everything disintegrated into a general melee of random savagery. The church knights discovered almost immediately that the grotesque creatures they faced did not seem to feel pain. It was impossible to determine if this was a natural characteristic of their species, or if whatever had unleashed them had provided them with some additional defense. Beneath their shaggy fur lay a hide of unnatural toughness. This is not to say that swords bounced off them, but more often than not they did not cut cleanly. The best strokes opened only minimal wounds. The Piloi, however, appeared to be having greater success with their sabers. The quick thrust of a sharp-pointed weapon was more effective than the massive overhand blow of heavy broadswords, and once their leathery hides had been penetrated, the savage brutes howled with pain. Strogan, his eyes alight, rode through the shaggy mass, the point of his slender rapier dancing, avoiding the clumsy strokes of stone axes, slipping the brutal thrusts of flint-tipped spears, and then sinking effortlessly, almost delicately, deep into fur-covered bodies.
"Sparhawk!" he shouted. "Their hearts are lower down in their bodies. Thrust at the belly, not the chest."
It grew easier then. The church knights altered their tactics, thrusting with the points of their swords rather than chopping with the broad blades. Bavier regretfully hung his lochaber from his saddle horn and drew his sword. Curic discarded his mace and drew his short blade. Ulith, however, stubbornly clung to his axe. His only concession to the exigencies of the situation was to use both hands to swing the weapon. His prodigious strength was sufficient to overcome such natural defenses as horn-tough hide and inch-thick skulls. The tide of the struggle turned, then. The huge, uncomprehending beasts were unable to adjust to a changing situation, and more of them fell to the thrusting swords. One last small cluster continued to fight even after the majority of their packmates had been slain, but the lightning-like dashes of Kring's warriors whittled them away. The last one left standing was bleeding from a dozen saber thrusts. He raised his brutish face and shrieked that high-pitched ululation. The sound cut off abruptly as Ulith rode in, stood up in his stirrups to raise his axe high overhead, and then split the wailing brute's head from crown to chin. Sparhawk wheeled, his bloody sword in his fist. But all the creatures had fallen. He looked around more closely. Their victory had been costly. A dozen of Kring's men had been felled. Not merely felled, but torn apart as well. And fully as many lay groaning on the bloody ground. Kring sat cross-legged on the turf, cradling the head of one of his dying men. His face was filled with sorrow. "I'm sorry, Domi," Sparhawk said. "Find out how many of your men are injured. We'll work out some way to have them cared for. How close would you say we are to the lands of your people?"
"A day and a half of hard riding, friend Sparhawk," Kring replied, sadly closing the vacant eyes of the warrior who had just died. "A bit less than 20 leagues.
Sparhawk rode toward the rear where Bayret sat his horse with his axe in his hands, guarding Talon and Sophrenia.
Is it over?
Sifrania asked, her eyes averted.
Yes, Sparhawk replied, dismounting.
What were they, little mother? They looked like trolls, but Ulith didn't think they really were.
They were dawn men, Sparhawk. It's a very old and very difficult spell. The gods and a few of the most powerful magicians of Styricum can reach back into time and bring things, creatures and men, forward. The dawn men haven't walked this earth for countless thousands of years. That's what we all were once. Elenes, Styrix, even trolls.
Are you saying that humans and trolls are related? He asked her incredulously.
Distantly. We've all changed over the eons. Trolls went one way and we went another.
Gnome's frozen instant doesn't appear to be as safe as we thought it was.
No, definitely not.
I think it's time to set the sun in motion again. We don't seem to be able to hide from whatever's chasing us by slipping through the cracks in time, and Styric magic doesn't work here. We'll be safer in ordinary time.
I think you're right, Sparhawk.
Sparhawk took Belium from its pouch once more and commanded Gnomb to break the spell. Kring's Piloi fashioned litters in which to carry their dead and wounded, and the party moved on, relieved to some degree that the birds actively flew now, and that the sun was moving once again. The next morning a roving Piloi patrol found them, and Kring rode forth to confer with his friends. His face was bleak when he returned.
"The Zamoks are setting fire to the grass," he said angrily.
"I won't be able to help you much longer, friend Sparhawk. We have to protect our pastures, and that means we'll have to spread out all over our lands."
Xavier looked at him speculatively.
"Wouldn't it be easier if the Zamoks all gathered in one place, Domi?" he asked.
"It would indeed, friend Xavier. But why would they do that?"
"To capture something of value, friend Kring."
Kring looked interested.
"Such as what?"
"Gold,"
Xavier shrugged.
"And women, and your herds?"
Kring looked shocked.
"It would be a trap, of course," Xavier continued. "You gather all your herds and your treasures and your womenfolk in one place with only a few of your Piloi to guard them. Then take the rest of your warriors and ride off, making sure that Zamok's scouts can see you leave. Then, once it gets dark, you slip back and take up positions nearby, keeping well out of sight. The Zamoks will all come running to steal your herds and treasures and women. Then you can fall on them all at once. That way you spare yourself the trouble of hunting them down one by one. Besides, it would give your women a glorious opportunity to witness your bravery. I'm told that women melt with love when they have the chance to watch their menfolk destroy a hated enemy."
Xavier's grin was sly. Kring's eyes narrowed as he thought it over.
"I like it," he burst out after a moment. "God strike me blind if I don't. We'll do it."
And he rode off to tell his people.
"Xavier," Tinian said, "sometimes you amaze me."
"It's a fairly standard strategy for light cavalry, Tinian," the young Cyrenix said modestly.
"I came across it in my study of military history. Lamarck barons used that ploy a number of times before they started building castles."
"I know, but you actively suggested using women for bait."
"I think you're just a little more worldly than you appear, my friend."
Xavier blushed. They followed after Kring at a somewhat slower pace, hindered by the wounded and the sorrowful line of horses carrying the dead. Carlton had a distant look on his face, and he seemed to be counting something up on his fingers.
"What's the trouble?" Sparhawk asked him.
"I'm trying to figure out just how much time we gained on Martell." "Not quite a day and a half," Talon said promptly. "A day and a third, actually. We're about 6 or 7 hours behind him now. We average about a league an hour."
20 miles, then," Carlton said.
"You know, Sparhawk, if we rode all night tonight, we could be right inside his camp when the sun rises tomorrow."
"We're not going to ride at night, Carlton. There's something very unfriendly out there, and I'd rather not have it surprise us in the dark." They made camp at sunset, and after they had eaten, Sparhawk and the others gathered in a large pavilion to consider their options. "We more or less know what we're going to do," Sparhawk began. "Getting to the border shouldn't be any problem. Kring's going to lead his men away from his womenfolk anyway,
so we'll have most of the Piloi warriors with us for at least part of the way. That's going to keep the Zamok conventional forces at a distance, so we'll be safe from them until we reach the border. It's after we cross that line that we'll run into trouble, and the key to that is Martell. We're still going to have to push him to the point that he won't have time to gather up Zamoks to stand in our way.
Make up your mind, Sparhawk, Colton said. First you say you're not going to ride at night, and then you say you're going to push Martell.
We don't have to be actually on top of him to push him, Colton. As long as he thinks we're close, he'll start running. I think I'll have a little talk with him while I've still got some daylight. He looked around. I'll need about a dozen candles, he said. Barrett, would you mind?
Of course not, Sir Sparhawk.
Set them up on this table, close together and all in a row.
Sparhawk reached inside his surcoat and took out the Belliarm again. He put it down on the table and laid a cloth over it to hide its seduction. When the lighted candles were in place, he uncovered the jewel and laid his ringed hands upon it.
Blue Rose, he commanded, bring Quadge to me.
The stone grew hot under his hands again, and the glowing red spot appeared deep within its petals.
Quadge, Sparhawk said sharply, you know me. I will see the place where my enemy will sleep tonight. Make it appear in the fire, Quadge. Now.
The howl of anger was no longer a howl, but had diminished to a sullen whine. The candle flames lengthened, and their edges joined to form a solid sheet of bright yellow fire. The image appeared in the fire. It was a small encampment, 3 tents only, and it lay in a grassy basin with a small lake at its center. A grove of dark cedar trees stood across the lake from the camp, and a single campfire flickered in the lowering dusk at the center of that half-circle of tents on the lakeshore. Sparhawk carefully fixed the details in his mind.
Take us closer to the fire, Quadge, he barked. Make it so that we can hear what is being said.
The image changed as the apparent viewpoint drew nearer. Martell and the others sat around the fire, their faces gaunt with exhaustion. Sparhawk motioned to his friends, and they all leaned forward to listen.
Where are they, Martell? Arissa was asking acidly. Where are these brave Zamoks you counted on to protect us? Gathering wildflowers?
They're diverting the Piloi, Princess, Martell replied. Do you really want those savages to catch up with us?
Don't worry, Arissa. If your appetites are growing uncontrollable, I'll lend you Adis. He doesn't smell very nice, but that's no great drawback where you're concerned, is it?
Her eyes blazed with sudden hatred, but Martell ignored her.
The Zamoks will hold off the Piloi, he said to Aeneas, and unless Sparhawk's been riding horses to death, which he'd never do, he's still 3 days behind us. We don't really need any Zamoks until we cross the border. That's when I'll want to find some of them to start laying traps for my dear brother and his friends.
Quadge, Sparhawk said shortly. Make it so that they can hear me. Now.
The candle flames flickered, then steadied again.
Awfully nice camp you have there, Martell, Sparhawk said in an offhand manner. Are there any fish in the lake?
Sparhawk, Martell gasped. How can you reach this far?
Far, old boy? It's not really all that far at all. I'm almost on top of you. If it had been me, though, I'd have made camp in that cedar grove across the lake. There are whole races of people who want to kill you, brother mine, and it's hardly safe to make camp right out in the open the way you have.
Martell sprang to his feet.
Get the horses!
He shouted to Adis. Leaving so soon, Martell? Sparhawk asked mildly.
What a shame. I was so looking forward to meeting you face to face again.
Oh, well, no matter. I'll see you first thing in the morning. I think we can both stand to wait that long.
Sparhawk's grin was vicious as he watched the five of them saddling their horses. Their movements were panicky, and their eyes darted about wildly. They clambered onto their mounts and bolted off toward the east at a dead run, flogging their horses unmercifully.
Come back, Martell, Sparhawk called after them. You forgot your tents.
Chapter 23 The land of the Piloi was a vast, unfenced grassland that had never known the touch of the plow. The winds of late autumn swept that eternal grassland under a lowering sky, sighing a mournful dirge for summer. They rode eastward toward a high, rocky pinnacle out in the center of the plain, with their cloaks drawn tightly around them to ward off the arid chill, and with their mood made somber by the unending gloom. They reached the rock pinnacle late that afternoon, and found the land around it bustling with activity. Kring, who had gone on ahead to gather the Piloi, rode up to meet them, a rough bandage encircling his head. "What happened to you, friend Kring?" Tinian asked him. "There was some small dissatisfaction with Sir Bavier's plan, I'm afraid," Kring replied ruefully. "One of the dissidents slipped up behind me. I wouldn't have thought Piloi warriors would attack from the rear." "Of course they wouldn't, but my attacker wasn't a man. A Piloi woman of high rank sneaked around behind me and banged me on the head with a cooking pot." "I hope you had her suitably punished." "I couldn't really do that, friend Tinian. She's my own sister. Our mother would never have forgiven me if I'd had the little brat flogged. None of the women liked Bavier's idea at all, but my sister was the only one who dared to reprimand me about it." "Are your women folk concerned about their own safety?" Bavier asked him. "Of course not. They're as brave as lionesses. What does concern them is the fact that one of them will be placed in charge of this women's camp. Piloi women are very sensitive about status. All the menfolk thought your plan was a splendid idea, but the women..." He spread his hands helplessly. "What man can ever understand a woman?" He squared his shoulders then and got down to business. "I've put my sub-chiefs to work on organizing the camp here. We'll leave a minimal force, and all the rest of us will make some show of riding toward the Zamok border as if we planned to invade. From time to time at night, we'll detach forces to sneak back here and take up positions in the surrounding hills to wait for the Zamoks. You'll all ride along and slip away when we get near the border." "A very sound plan, friend Kring," Tinian approved. "I sort of thought so myself." Kring grinned. "Come along, my friends. I'll take you to the tents of my clan. We're roasting a span of oxen for supper. We'll take salt together and talk of affairs." He seemed to think of something. "Friend Stragan," he said, "you know the Tamil woman Murtai better than our other friends do. Is she at all gifted in the art of cooking?"
"I've never eaten anything she prepared, Domi," Stragan admitted. "She once told us of a journey she made on foot when she was a girl, though. As I understand it, she subsisted primarily on wolf."
"Wolf? How do you cook a wolf?"
"I don't think she did. She was in a hurry, I guess, so she just ate the wolf as she went."
Kring swallowed very hard.
"She ate him raw?" he asked in wonder.
"How did she manage to catch one?"
Stragan shrugged. "Chased him down, more than likely," he replied. "Then she tore off some of the choicer parts and ate him as she ran."
"The poor wolf!" Kring exclaimed. Then he looked suspiciously at the Thalesian thief. "Are you making this up, Stragan?" he demanded.
"Me?"
Stragan's ice-blue eyes were as innocent as those of a child. They rode out at dawn the next morning, and Kring came back to ride beside Sparhawk. "Stragan was only trying to fool me last night, wasn't he, Sparhawk?" he asked with a worried look.
"Probably," Sparhawk replied. "The Thalesians are a strange people, and they have a peculiar sense of humor."
"She could probably do it, though," Kring said in admiration. "Chase down a wolf and eat him raw, I mean."
"I suppose she could if she wanted to," Sparhawk admitted. "I see that you're still thinking of her."
"I think of very little else, Sparhawk. I've tried to push her from my mind, but it's of no use," he sighed. "My people will never accept her, I'm afraid. It might be all right if my rank were not such as it is, but if I marry her, she'll be Doma among the Piloi, the Domi's mate and chief among the women. The other women would gnaw their livers in jealousy and would speak against her to their husbands. Then the men would speak against her in our councils, and I'd have to kill many of the friends I've had since boyhood. Her presence among us would tear my people asunder." He sighed again. "Perhaps I can arrange to get myself killed during the impending war.
That way I can avoid making the choice between love and duty. He straightened in his saddle. Enough of such womanly talk, he said. After my people and I have annihilated the main force of the Zamoks, we'll harry the border country on both sides of the line. The Zamoks will have little time to concern themselves with you and your friends. Zamoks are easy to divert. We'll destroy their shrines and temples. That drives them insane for some reason. You've thought this through rather carefully, haven't you, Kring? It's always good to know where you're going, Sparhawk. When we march eastward, we'll stay on the road that leads northeasterly toward the Zamok town of Vileta. Listen carefully, my friend. You're going to need directions if you want to find that pass I mentioned earlier. He then spoke at some length to tell Sparhawk which way to go, stressing landmarks and distances as he went along. That's about it, friend Sparhawk, he concluded. I wish I could do more. Are you sure you wouldn't like to have me bring a few thousand horsemen and come along with you? I wouldn't mind the company, Kring, Sparhawk replied, but that large a force would draw resistance, and that would delay us. We have friends on the plains of Lamorkand who are counting on us to reach the Temple of Azash before the Zamoks overwhelm them. I understand completely, friend Sparhawk. They rode east for 2 days, and then Kring told Sparhawk that he should turn south in the morning. I'd advise leaving about 2 hours before daylight, friend Sparhawk, he said. If some Zamok scout sees you and your friends ride out of the encampment in the daylight, he might get curious and follow you. The country to the south is fairly flat, so riding in the dark won't be all that dangerous. Good luck, my friend. There's a very great deal riding on your shoulders. We'll pray for you, when we're not busy killing Zamoks. The moon was rising above scattered clouds when Sparhawk came out of their pavilion for a breath of fresh air. Strogan followed him. Nice night, the slender blonde man said in his resonant voice. A bit chilly, though, Sparhawk replied. Who'd want to live in a land of endless summer? I probably won't see you when you ride out, Sparhawk. I'm not what you'd call an early riser. Strogan reached inside his doublet and drew out a packet of paper somewhat thicker than the previous ones. This is the last of them, he said, handing over the packet. I've completed the task your queen laid upon me. You did well, Strogan, I guess. Give me a little more credit than that, Sparhawk. I did exactly as Alana commanded. You could have saved yourself a long ride if you'd just given me all the letters at once, you know. I didn't mind the ride all that much. I rather like you and your companions, you know. Not enough to emulate your overwhelming nobility, of course, but I do like you. I like you too, Strogan. Not enough to trust you, of course, but well enough, I suppose. Thank you, Sir Knight, Strogan said with a mocking bow. Don't mention it, milord. Sparhawk grinned. Be careful in Zamok, my friend, Strogan said seriously. I'm very fond of your iron-willed young queen, and I'd rather you didn't break her heart by doing something stupid. Also, if Talon tells you to do something, pay attention to him. I know he's just a boy and a thief to boot, but he has very good instincts and a rather astounding mind. It's altogether possible that he's the most intelligent person either of us will ever meet. Besides, he's lucky. Don't lose, Sparhawk. I don't much fancy bowing down to Azash. He made a face. Enough of that. I've got a maudlin streak in me sometimes. Let's go back inside and crack open a flagon or two for old time's sake. Unless you want to read your mail. I think I'll save it. I may get downhearted somewhere in Zamok, and I'll need something to lift my spirits at that point. The clouds had once again obscured the moon as they gathered early the next morning. Sparhawk sketched in their route, laying some stress on the landmarks Kring had mentioned. Then they mounted and rode out of the camp. The darkness was so dense as to be virtually impenetrable. We could be riding around in circles out here, you know, Colton complained, his voice slightly sullen. Colton had sat up late with the Piloi the previous evening, and his eyes had been bloodshot and his hands palsied when Sparhawk had awakened him. Just keep riding, Colton, Sophronia told him. Of course, he said sarcastically. But which way?
Southeast.
Fine. But which way is southeast?
That way.
She pointed off into the darkness.
How do you know?
She spoke rapidly to him in Styric for a moment.
There, she said. That should explain everything to you.
Little mother, I did not understand one single word you said.
That's not my fault, dear one.
The dawn came slowly that morning, since the cloud banks lying to the east were particularly dense. As they rode south, they began to see the outlines of ragged peaks lying leagues off to the east, peaks that could only be in Zamok. It was late in the morning when Keurig reined in.
There's that red peak you mentioned, Sparhawk, he said, pointing.
It looks as if it's bleeding, doesn't it? Calton observed. Or is that just my eyes?
A little of each, perhaps, Calton, Sophronia said. You shouldn't have drunk so much ale last night.
You should have told me about that last night, little mother, he said mournfully.
Very well, gentlemen, she said. It's time for you to change clothing, I think. Your armor might be a bit ostentatious in Zamok. Put on your mail shirts if you must, but I have Styric smocks for each of you. After you've changed, I'll do something about your faces.
I'm more or less used to mine, Euleth told her.
You may be, Euleth, but it might startle the Zamoks.
The five knights and Bayrit removed their formal armor, the knights with a certain relief and Bayrit with obvious reluctance. Then they pulled on their only slightly less uncomfortable chain mail, and lastly the Styric smocks. Sophronia looked at them critically.
Leave your sword belts on over the smocks for now, she said. I doubt that the Zamoks have any really set customs about how they wear their weapons. If we find out differently later, we can make adjustments. Now stand still, all of you.
She went from man to man, touching their faces and repeating the same Styric incantation for each of them.
It didn't seem to have worked, Lady Sophronia, Davia said, looking around at his companions. They all still look the same to me.
I'm not trying to disguise them from you, Bavier.
She went to her saddlebag and took out a small hand mirror.
This is how the Zamoks will see you.
She handed him the mirror.
Bavier took one look and then made the sign to ward off evil. Dear God, he gasped. I look hideous.
He handed the mirror quickly to Sparhawk, and Sparhawk examined his strangely altered face carefully. His hair was still horsetail black, but his weathered skin had become pale, a racial characteristic of all Styrics. His brows and cheekbones had become prominent, almost rough-hewn. Sophronia, he noted with a certain disappointment, had left his nose as it was. As much as he told himself that he really didn't mind the broken nose all that much, he nonetheless found that he had been curious to find out just how he might appear with a straight one for a change.
"I've made you resemble a pure Styric strain," she told them. It's common enough in Zamok, and I'm more comfortable with it. The sight of a mixed Eline and Styric nauseates me for some reason.
Then she extended her right arm, spoke at some length in Styric, and then gestured. A dark spiral band that looked much like a tattoo encircled her forearm and wrist, and culminated in an amazingly lifelike representation of a snake's head on her palm.
"There's a reason for that, I suppose?" Finian said, looking curiously at the marking.
Of course. Shall we go, then?
The border between Pelosia and Zamok was ill-defined, seeming to lie along a meandering line marked by the end of the tall grass. The soil to the east of that line was thin and rocky, and the vegetation stunted. The dark edge of a coniferous forest lay a mile or so up the steep slope. When they had covered perhaps half that distance, a dozen riders in dirty white smocks emerged from the trees and approached them.
"I'll handle this," Sophronia said. "Just don't say anything, any of you, and try to look menacing."
The approaching Zamoks reined in. Some of them had those unfinished-looking Styric features. Some could easily pass for Alines, and some appeared to be an unwholesome mixture of the two.
"All glory to the dread god of the Zamoks,"
their leader intoned in bastardized Styric. The tongue he spoke was a mixture of that tongue and Eline, combining the worst features of both languages.
"You did not say his name, Kejek,"
Sophronia said coldly.
"How did she know the fellow's name?"
Calton whispered to Sparhawk. Calton obviously understood more Styric than he could pronounce.
Kejek isn't a name, Sparhawk replied. It's an insult. The Zaymok's face went even more pale, and his black eyes narrowed with hate. Women and slaves do not speak so to members of the Imperial Guard, he snapped.
Imperial Guard? Sophronia sneered. Neither you nor any of your men would make a wart on any part of an Imperial Guardsman.
Say the name of our God so that I may know that you are of the true faith.
Say it, Kejek, lest ye die.
Azash, the now uncertain man muttered.
His name is fouled by the tongue that speaks it, she told him. But Azash sometimes enjoys defilement.
The Zaymok straightened.
I am commanded to gather the people, he declared. The day is at hand when blessed Otho will stretch forth his fist to crush and enslave the unbelievers of the West.
Obey then. Continue with your work. Be diligent, for Azash rewards lack of zeal with agonies.
I need no woman to instruct me, he said coldly. Prepare to take your servants to the place of war.
Your authority does not extend to me. She raised her right hand, her palm toward him. The markings about her forearm and wrist seemed to writhe and surge, and the image of the snake's head hissed, its forked tongue flickering.
You have my permission to greet me, she told him.
The Zaymok recoiled, his eyes wide with horror. Since the ritual styric greeting involved the kissing of the palms, Sophronia's permission was an open invitation to suicide.
Forgive me, High Priestess, he begged in a shaking voice.
I don't think so, she said flatly. She looked at the other Zaymoks, who were goggle-eyed with fright.
This piece of offal has offended me, she told them. Do what is customary.
The Zaymoks leaped from their saddles, pulled their struggling leader from his horse, and beheaded him on the spot. Sophronia, who normally would have viewed such savagery with revulsion, looked on with no change of expression.
Adequate, she said flatly. Display what remains of him in the usual fashion and go on with your task.
Dread Priestess, one of them faltered.
We have no leader now.
You have spoken, therefore you will lead. If you do well, you will be rewarded. If you do not do well, the punishment will be on your head. Now take this carrion out of my path.
She touched Kiel's flanks with her heels, and the slender white mare moved forward, delicately avoiding the puddles of blood on the ground.
Leadership among the Zaymoks appears to have certain hazards, Euloth observed to Tinian.
Truly, Tinian agreed.
Did you really have to do that to him, Lady Sophronia? Xavier asked in a choked voice.
Yes. A Zaymok who offends the priesthood is always punished, and in Zaymok there is only one punishment.
How did you make the picture of the snake move? Talon asked her, his eyes a little frightened.
I didn't, she replied. It only seemed to move.
Then it wouldn't really have bitten him, would it?
He'd have thought it had, and the results would have been the same.
How far did Kring tell you to go into this forest, Sparhawk?
About a day's ride, he told her. We turn south at the eastern edge of the woods, just before we get to the mountains.
Let's ride on, then. They were all a bit awed by the apparent change in Sophronia. The soulless arrogance she had displayed during the encounter with the Zaymoks had been so radically different from her normal behavior that she even frightened them to some degree. They rode on through the shadowy forest in subdued silence, casting frequent looks in her direction. Finally, she reined in her palfrey.
"Will you all stop that?" she said tartly. "I haven't grown another head, you know. I'm posing as a Zaymok priestess, and I'm behaving in exactly the way a priestess of Azash would. When you imitate a monster, you sometimes have to do monstrous things. Now let's ride on. Tell us a story, Tinian. Take our minds off the recent unpleasantness."
"Yes, little mother," the broad-faced Aeirin agreed. Sparhawk had noticed that they had all, unconsciously perhaps, taken to addressing her in that form.
They camped in the forest that night and continued the following morning under still cloudy skies. They were climbing steadily through the forest, and as they progressed, the air grew colder. It was about midday when they reached the eastern edge of the wood and turned south, staying perhaps 100 yards back under the trees to take advantage of the concealment they offered. As Kring had advised Sparhawk they would, they reached an extensive grove of blighted trees late in the day. The stark white band of dead trees spilled down from the mountainside like a leprous waterfall, foul-smelling, fungus-ridden, and about a league wide. "This place looks and smells like the outskirts of hell," Tinian said in a somber voice. "Maybe it's because of the cloudy weather," Colton told him.
"I don't think sunshine would help this place very much," Ulith disagreed.
"What could have laid waste so vast a region?" Aviar asked with a shudder.
"The earth itself is diseased," Sifrania told him. "Let's not linger too long in this accursed wood, dear ones. A man is not a tree, but the noxious miasma of this forest cannot be healthy."
"We're losing daylight, Sifrania," Curic said.
"That won't be a problem. There'll be light enough for us to press on after it grows dark."
"What was it that diseased the earth, Lady Sifrania?" Beirut asked, looking around at the white trees thrusting upward from the contaminated soil like imploring skeletal hands.
"There's no way to know, Beirut, but the reek of this place is the reek of death. Horrors beyond imagining may lie under the ground. Let's put this place behind us."
The sky darkened with the approach of evening, but as night fell, the dead trees around them began to give off a sickly, greenish glow.
"Are you doing this, Sifrania?" Colton asked.
"Making the light, I mean?"
"No," she replied. "The light isn't the result of magic."
Curic laughed a bit ruefully.
"I should have remembered that," he said.
"Remembered what?"
Talon asked him. "Rotten logs and the like glow in the dark sometimes."
"I didn't know that."
"You've spent too much time in cities, Talon."
"You have to go where your customers are."
The boy shrugged.
"You don't make much profit swindling frogs."
They rode on through the first hours of night in that faint greenish glow, covering their noses and mouths with their cloaks. Not long before midnight, they reached a steep forested ridge. They rode on for some distance and then set up camp for the remainder of the night, in a shallow wooded basin where the night air seemed unusually sweet and pure after the endless hours and the fetid stink of the dead forest. The prospect they viewed the following morning as they crested the ridge was not a great deal more encouraging. What they had faced the previous day had been dead white. What lay in store for them today was just as dead. But it was black.
"What on earth is that?"
Talon gasped, staring out over the bubbling expanse of sticky-looking black muck.
"The tar bogs," Kring mentioned, Sparhawk replied.
"Can we go around them?"
"No. The tar seeps out of the face of a cliff, and the bogs run on for leagues out into the foothills."
The tar bogs appeared to be vast puddles of shiny black, glistening wet, bubbling, and stretching to a rocky spur perhaps 5 miles to the south. Near the far side there rose a plume of bluish flame quite nearly as tall as the spire rising above the Cathedral of Simera.
"How can we hope to cross that?" Davier exclaimed.
"Carefully, I'd imagine," Ulith replied. "I've crossed a few quicksand bogs up in Thalasia. You spend a lot of time probing in front of you with a stick. A long one, preferably."
"The Piloi have the trail marked," Sparhawk assured them. "They've poked sticks into solid ground."
"Which side of the sticks are we supposed to stay on?" Colton asked.
"Kring didn't say." Sparhawk shrugged. "I imagine we'll find out before we go very far, though." They rode down the ridge and moved at a careful walk out into the sticky black quagmire. The air hanging above the bogs was thick with the penetrating odor of naphtha, and Sparhawk began to feel somewhat lightheaded after a short distance. End of side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over.